Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. And every week, it seems more than just every week these days, but anyway, it seems like a lot, but I've got the lovely John Curtis here with me once again to enjoy a wonderful podcast with. John,
welcome. That sounded like a complaint, dear boy.
No, not even slightly. It's so exciting because we're getting to talk to so many wonderful pioneers, collaborators and innovators in our industry. And actually, we've got somebody that I have known for a number of years today. Somebody that is somebody I've wanted on this podcast for a long, long time, ever since we really started it. So I'm really excited to say that we have Glenn Saint. Glenn, welcome to the EV Cafe podcast.
Hi, Paul, John, nice to be with you this morning.
Lovely to be with you. May I start, Glenn, by asking, is it Saint by name, Saint by nature?
The number of times. If I had a pound for every time somebody had asked that question, I'd be a very rich man. But
we get the obvious things out of the way, now answer the question.
Yeah, not at all. Sometimes, but though my wife would have other views, I'm sure.
Well, and so for those of you out there that are unfamiliar with the name Glenn Saint, and you may be, but Glenn has a particular close to my heart claim to fame. So Glenn, why don't you, and you know what I'm talking about, so don't sort of say that it was playing football for the Busby Babes in 1960 whatever or something like that, which might be true, I don't know. Tell us, Glenn, why do I particularly, the Paul the Electric Van Man, want to talk to you?
Well, 10 years ago, coming on 11, I was responsible for starting a rival in the UK. Wow. So I met June of 2014, I met a young man by the name of Dennis Sverdlov, who was the founder of the business, which was then called Charge. And I was asked if I would start the UK hardware end of the business for him. We had some particular ideas that Dennis wanted to pursue, and my background was in electric trucks and buses from the past, and so I was asked, would I set up a rival? And so I met Dennis in 2014 in some very interesting locations. The first time I met Dennis, Dennis was living and had an office in Wapping, and so I was invited to go and meet him, and I arrive in Wapping at this big building and announce that I'm going to go there. And the lady at the desk says, oh, I'll let you in. She takes me over to the lift, and this lift opens a bit like the Dragon's Den, and she puts a key in a lock and turns the key and says, off you go. So you could only access the upper apartment of this building by a key, and I go in there, and it is just like Dragon's Den. The doors of the lift open, and there's a scrubbed wooden floor, occasional furniture. And I met this gentleman who had the most amazing phone at the time, something I'd never seen, a two-screen phone, and back of his phone, the image kept changing. I'm thinking, what am I getting into here? This is a Russian guy. Am I going to get out of here alive? But I did. And, Dennis and I have had a great relationship ever since. I can't believe the things we did over the 10 years. It wasn't any of the things that we set out to do right at the start or the job I took, but it was a roller coaster ride, and it was really a fantastic time in my career, without a doubt. It was really good fun.
And just for, because we've got to get the obvious out of the way, who came up with the name that has ended up being probably the most ironic epitaph ever?
The arrival name was interesting. We changed to arrival, I think, around 2017. And we had a gentleman who joined the business who was a real live wire, a guy called Justin Cook, who sadly took his own life a couple of years later. Gosh. It was a really sad situation, that. But that Justin was driving the company, and indeed was a sort of right-hand man to Dennis. They used to bounce ideas off each other, and he'd had a background in retail environment, that sort of thing, and was another really exceptional individual. And I think it was him that suggested that the name should be changed, and the fact that the business in 2017 was really exploding into lots of different transport areas, that Justin suggested we needed a rebrand. We were Charge. The Charge name went on. We had a small part of the business that was electrifying. Well, it was started off as it was going to be classic cars, but it ended up centering on a Ford Mustang shell. That we did end up not ripping old cars apart, which was the original idea. We left that alone and started making our own version of an older car. And the Charge name lived on there. But Arrival became the brand for everything else. The van was most prominent. But of course, as you know, Paul, we were doing buses. We had a car project with Uber. And there were lots of other things in the wings. At every level, from software to component to vehicle. So it wasn't just vehicles. It was a whole gambit.
And your role within that, Glenn, is that one of being an engineer? You're a technical person?
Yes. Through and through, I'm an engineer. I started effectively as the chief technical officer for the UK, but also the managing director, because I was the only director for the first few years, and continued as a legal director of many of the Arrival and Charge companies up until the point the business was IPO'd in 2021. So my roles were many, as most people within Arrival would also be. You know, everybody who sort of joined Arrival, you couldn't be working for Arrival if you weren't happy with change. Because the job you were doing at one point was never the job you were going to be doing in 3 months' time. The change was that rapid. The direction was that rapid. In 2016, we built a factory in Banbury. We got ready to start producing some vans, and the direction changed with the advent of the microfactory idea. And we ended up using that facility as a development place, with a site which you know very well, Paul, but that originally was the factory for making vans and buses. We built it literally in 6 months, equipped it out, got it all ready, and by the time we were ready, the business had changed direction again. So that was the rapidity of change within Arrival, and we had some fantastic people.
And Glenn, because I mean, we have to come on to the fact, I don't want to do it prematurely, but you have to come on to the fact that Arrival didn't quite arrive, albeit, you know, they were on the scene for 10 years. You mention about change, and you mention about the diversity, and you know my view on this, the buses and the Uber and all of those kinds of things. The single-minded nature of where you started with this wonderful idea, and one that UPS bought into, you know, other companies were queuing at the door, and I was in one of those companies that ultimately signed a deal for, I think, 3,000 under a MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. Was it that, I'm going to say inability, you might kind of come up with a different sort of adjective for that, I suppose, but the inability to stay single-minded and focused on delivering one product and then making those other changes from there. Is that why, do you think, Arrival didn't get there, or is there something else?
I think more there were external factors, Paul. Yeah, we can all look in hindsight and say, well, if we'd have concentrated on that, we could have done something different. But at the time, with the way the market was and where the technology was going, we had several good products ready to launch. And, you know, I spent 2 years of my life preparing microfactories in 10 different locations across the world, ready to go. We were ready to sign on the dotted line with many of them. In February 2020, I got off a plane and never got back on because COVID hit. The market changed. The business plan to float the business went ahead, but the cash wasn't there. You know, if the technology had continued to be invested in for small sales of parts of the company, those projects could have been brought to fruition with the capital value that that business was given at the time. But that just didn't play out. And as we've seen with many other businesses in that arena, the necessary capital to invest to get to the next stage has not been forthcoming. And we're seeing lots of changes which are stalling the market at the moment. Yeah, there's lots of people point to, well, they were doing too much of this and they were doing too much of that. And to those people, I would say, well, you know, you weren't there, you weren't in that at the time. Decisions are taken at a point in time. And in life, you can always change what happens in the future, but you can never change what happened in the past. And you That's take a decision true. Based on the information you have around you at the time. And you can never know whether the other path you could have chosen would have been a better one. Lots of people are sort of armchair, you know, we'll sit in their armchair and talk about whether it was right or wrong, but they didn't have to make that decision. So it's easy to do. It's like commenting on the football, isn't it? We've all got an opinion, but, you know, if you're the manager in charge at the time, you're the guy that's got to decide who goes out onto the pitch. So
it would be really helpful, Glenn, I think, for me to look at a fact. And the fact that I'm really interested in is, what was the problem that you set out to solve at Arrival?
So I guess the single biggest problem, and I see this still in the industry today, when we talk about how do we electrify and how do we decarbonize the fleet, and it's price. So the goal was that we would build vehicles which would be the same or better total cost of operation has the diesel or petrol vehicle that they replace. Mm-hmm. Now, until you get to that point, we're talking about projects. The bus industry has been really good. They got lots of electric buses. Fine, but that's only because it's been subsidized by the government with their schemes. And they basically pay the difference in the cost of the product between a diesel product and an electric product. That's not sustainable. The only way the market will change big time, if I offered you today in your old role, Paul, that electric van at the same price or with a total cost of operation that I could prove was less and was going to save you money, you wouldn't buy anybody else's. You'd buy all of those electric vans because that, you know, that's what you would want to do. So that really is the thing that we set out to do. We set out to make those products more cost effective to operate than their current ICE equivalent. And that is, without a doubt, to me, that is still the key. Otherwise, we're all talking about government do this, government do that. You know, we need a market that does this. But if actually you achieve that and you make a product that's more beneficial to the end user commercially, then they're going to buy it. Why wouldn't they? So to answer your question, John, that's what we set out to do. Dennis is a true environmentalist, a real believer strongly in that, and he set out to do just that because he had the clear vision. Now, we're talking 10 years ago here, so we're hearing, I look on LinkedIn and I see the words microfactory and software-defined vehicle, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, before we arrived, that talk didn't exist. If you just said software-defined vehicle 10 years ago, they thought you were crazy, and they did think we were crazy. But we were there. We were first with it.
Yeah. And you know, I have been one of those armchair critics and looking through the window. And it is easy to say, and I I've had the privilege of working with an American startup recently that are doing something very similar, or have been trying to do something, and it's equally difficult for them. There's no question about it. And I think what people may not appreciate is the vision that you guys came to market with. And if we kind of think this is the time when the Nissan Leaf was just and the ENV 200 was just about getting over the line to the market, and a company like UPS wouldn't invest and sort of sign on the dotted line to do just any old vehicle. The benefits and you know, as I think back, you know, that cost effectiveness, that cost parity with diesel was one of the critical things, that the target, the goal, the software defined vehicle, the minimizing of downtime and getting the sort of size of the parts. I think it was in 10 centimeter increments and different bits and pieces like that. So many wonderful things. I mean, were these all your brainchild? Was this you and Dennis getting together and building the proposition? How did that proposition come about? And what in that element, because it's so much more than just environmental, it was uptime and efficiency and all of those good things. Where did that information knowledge come from and how did you build that proposition?
Well, Paul, it evolved. You know, we had so many good people within the company. Some ideas came from me, many came from Dennis. He was the real strategic thinker. But we brought into the business many, many more really clever people. And usually these people were maybe the top in the hierarchy of other businesses, but were following a traditional path because businesses gain inertia once you've got factories, once you've got people working in a particular direction. If you come up with a new way of thinking, it's very hard to get that in a traditional manufacturer. And Dennis made a culture where those ideas... there was no wrong ideas. Those ideas were accepted within the business to be discussed. Not all of them went forward, of course, but creating that culture meant that there were many people in the business at whatever level that could come up with these ideas, and they would be discussed, you know, critically and you know, unfairly. Unlike many other businesses where you go in, you know, if a guy comes in as an engineer and has a clever idea, there'll be somebody above him who tells him, no, you can't do that. We're not doing that. Yeah. And they get stifled. So, but equally it worked the other way. We had people join us from some of these automotive businesses that were comfortable in their very rigid little world, and they didn't fare well at arrival when all the barriers were taken down, and they were expected to think for themselves and come up with great ideas, and they generally would leave and go back. So you had to be receptive to change and open in your thinking, and that was really a clever thing. And that thinking, that culture really comes down to Dennis. It was something he wanted to open up and approach things differently in the automotive field because his background is software. So he always used to tell me the software part was easy. It was just ones and noughts. But I think we came to find that it was actually a little bit harder than that. But the idea was there.
I'd really like to explore, Glenn, if I can, rather than a lot of the painful things and the difficult things right now, some of the things that went well. So what are you really proud of that you were involved with as Arrival grew and scaled, that you achieved?
I think, well, there are several things that I'm going to call them all product, because I believe they are all product. And you will see now that out of that business has come businesses that are using that product. So I'll mention a couple. Soda, software defined vehicle. So part of our software team is thriving in that environment now. There's another business, Cinta, that was responsible for the after sales side, automating the after sales and aftercare. And that business has floated out of that. And we're seeing product as well. We're seeing people working, group of the team are operating as Minimal, which is Minimal is providing last mile delivery vehicles and processors. So out of that, those products that we created, physical products, we had the best bus out there. Have you ridden on a bus recently? They're horrible things. Mm. They bang and crash. And that's because buses are made the way they've always been. They're on the back of trucks, they've got truck axles under them and all sorts of horrible things. And Arrival said, well, that's rubbish. We'll put proper suspension on, lightweight the vehicle, put the battery in the bottom and develop an electric vehicle that's next generation. And it worked. And we ran that vehicle in Banbury for 3 months on a scheduled service. And it was all going in the right direction. And the van was similar. You know very well, you've driven it, Paul, all of the benefits that were delivered through that. And that's why companies like, forward-thinking companies like UPS bought into that. Mm. Because they wanted to do, there were businesses out there that wanted that next step. And most of the automotive businesses, commercial vehicle and in particular car businesses, are just not thinking. So you've got this point where I think a number of the automotives have got their heads in the sand or paying lip service to this change. And then there's a few others that are saying, actually, we're going to make 100% wholesale change here, and we're going to develop vehicles that are purely electric and that are not our last year's model with the engine ripped out and some bits thrown in. And that was, Arrival had the benefit, I guess, of being able to start from that position, clean sheet of paper. Mm. So I'm really proud of those vehicles, but not just the vehicles, the product that we invented. The Microfactory was a product. I hear everybody talking about that. I had people early on telling me, well, that's a ridiculous idea. You know, you need to build everything on a line and, you know... And we had some people come into the business with that mindset later on as well. But the actual initial thinking of, like, well, let's start from scratch. Here's where we are today. Forget what happened previously. Let's start all over again. And I had the benefit of selling that Microfactory idea across the world for 2 years. And you'd be surprised how many people picked up on that quite quickly. Mm. And could see the benefits that Arrival were going to bring into their marketplace. And we quickly gained launch customers, facilities, connections with government, ready to go. We were all ready to press that green button in early 2020 and really set off. But the world changed, sadly. Mm. Mm. So, yes, there's lots of things, and they still exist, John. This is the thing. I think out of that, not all of the IP has been sold on yet, but I believe it will be. And the people, you know, they learnt greatly from their time at Arrival and will be spreading that into the other companies within the UK and UK startups. So Arrival's legacy, if you want to call it that, is those people and that learning that have gone into all these new businesses and old businesses, where those people are able to now spread that they learnt within Arrival.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the engagement, I mean, the poster I managed to do on the factory, with my little walk around the factory in Banbury, and just reflected on the sadness of it coming to an end. And I do have an Arrival van seat from that factory sale. Anyway, that's an aside. It will become my desk chair one of these days. But anyway.
Yeah, it is a sadness, Paul, but what you got to think as well, this is another thing that I sort of learned from Dennis as well along the way, and we talked earlier about, you can't help the past, but you can do something with the future. So Dennis was very much, it is sad. It is sad what we've lost, but let's go. What are we going to do next? What are we going to do in the future? What are we going to do with that learning that we've got, and how can we advance that? And I think, as I just said earlier, that's what those people will do, having learned from arrival. They will spread that word in the future.
And that was what came across to me from the connection, because I had so many people messaging or putting in comments to that post around the positivity that has come from all of that stuff. And the network that Arrival have created in terms of people performing at the highest level of their game and have been challenged to think differently and embrace change and work with innovation, I think it's quite unrivaled, really, in terms of the impact. But I'm curious, Glenn, because, you know, sitting in front of us is an extremely rounded individual that has obviously kind of been through this journey. But I'm really curious, if you look back to your sort of younger self as you were sort of maybe leaving school and considering your options and all that sort of stuff, what was the Glenn like then? Did you have any inkling that you could... You could change the world in the way that you have?
None at all. So, I mean, you take steps in life, don't you? I always knew I wanted to be an engineer. My father's chief engineer, my father was an accountant, but he worked in a business. There was a chief engineer there that loaned me some books. And I thought, one day I want to be the chief engineer. You know, that's my role. I achieved that very young, in my 20s. And then went from there. You know, what do you do next? And I ran my own business for a period of time. By accident, ended up in commercial vehicles. I'm not sure you choose commercial vehicles, but they sort of choose you. I went on from there. I guess my primary role, I held most of the director's positions at Optare. And again, each time that changed, we changed. We bought and sold the business. Each time the ownership changed, each time the business changed, a new challenge was thrown up. So I was able to spend time in engineering, in manufacturing, in commercial roles, and after sales. I held most of the directors' positions at that business, with the exception of finance. So you can't see that as a young man, but what I would say is, somebody once said to me, you get a lot of luck in life, but you know what? The harder you work, the more luck you get. And I think that's very, very true. And I've been very lucky in that my wife and I have a very traditional relationship. She managed the family and I managed work. And I missed out a bit on the kids growing up at times. I guess that's a regret. But when it came to business, I was able to focus 100% of my time and attention to what we were doing, because I didn't have to worry about the school run or any of those other things in the background. Fortunately, didn't have to work most of the time and was able to carry on with that. So we had a very traditional lifestyle in that way. And that enabled me to take the next step each time. And I wouldn't be able to say to anybody who's 17, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you meet people in all sorts of different walks of life. So if somebody said to you, you're going to be in environmentally sustainable decarbonisation of commercial vehicles, you don't know that. You can't know that at 17. You know, when I was growing up at school in the 1970s, anybody who thought about decarbonisation was really weird and had a beard and tended to drive around in a diesel, because that was the green thing to do at the time. And we had a fuel crisis. Through all that time, we as engineers develop solutions. So, and look to waste. So as a young teenager, I was making solar panels and sticking them to the roof of the garage, not because I wanted to save the planet, but because I was getting something for nothing. It was cheap. It was free. You know, I was getting free hot water and free electricity. And I thought that was cool. And it sort of develops from there. And we provide, so people come along to you, well, we've got this problem. We need to decarbonize. As an engineer, you sit down. Right, how are we going to do that? We'll come up with a solution. So when people deliver a problem, so you go through, and I've gone through and ended up, you know, as somewhat of an expert in sustainability, in commercial vehicles, etc. But I didn't start, as they say, you don't start from here, as it were. It sort of, you take steps in your career over time, and, you know, these things play out.
You strike me as somebody who sees a problem and engineers a solution. And that's relatively simple in the physical world, Glenn, I guess, in that, you know, you have formulas, you have processes, you have things that that you know you can trust, science. However, you spoke earlier about your colleague who took his own life and the challenges that business can bring. And clearly, the demise of a rival, with you having invested so much of your own energy and brain power, that must have caused you some serious pain. And you can't just engineer a solution. How did you cope with that challenge to your well-being?
I think, well, that's very emotionally level-headed with these things. And as we said earlier on, I cannot change anything that happened yesterday, but I can change what happens tomorrow. So you have to have that philosophy. Yeah, sure, we all feel sad at some point. You look back and think, well, what if I'd done this and what if I'd done that? But if I spend all day thinking about that, I won't be thinking about how I'm going to do something new tomorrow. And I've always had that sort of, that's my emotion. So I just get on and look at the problem and say, right, what are we going to do next? And I've had fortunate enough to have the backup in family who've prepared to support that when, and it was a big change to go to a rival in the first place. So I took Optair, for example, through several changes of ownership. We sold out as an MBO in 2008, and we sold to some people that made a total mess of it. I was asked to help rebuild that with a guy called Jim Sumner, who was ex-Leyland, and we did that. And I could have sat there in my comfortable director's chair and waited until I got my pension. And then this interesting gentleman came along and said, why don't you come and do this for me? And that was probably one of the biggest times when I've had to think, you know, do I sit here comfortably and take my director's pension when it comes, or do I do this exciting thing over there and risk everything? And we did it, and I'm glad I did. You know, a rival nearly died in the first 3 months of its conception. The charge was set up in 2014. There was an idea, there was some work we were planning to work on, and it didn't come to fruition. And Dennis said to me, look, you know, for this to go forward, we've got to build an electric truck in the next 6 months. This has not come off. So do we lay everybody off or do we go for it? And we decided to go for it.
Thank goodness.
In 6 months, we built, so by the middle of 2015, we'd built the first electric 7.5-ton truck, which at that time was a collection of technologies that were available, and we integrated it, and we proved to Dennis and our shareholders that that was a way forward, and we went from there and started developing into the components and developing the intellectual property around the whole gambit. So it very nearly didn't happen, but I'd say, you know, in answer to your question, you just dig deep and look to the next day, because you can't do anything about what happened yesterday. And, you know, thinking about it's really wasting your time and effort.
You really are destined to be the best engineer in the world. I love that approach to life. It's totally counter to how I deal with stuff, but it's refreshing to get another perspective on how you deal with challenges.
So you're influenced by people throughout your life, and as a very young apprentice in I started at Rolls-Royce, and you see various people throughout that, and one of the guys said to me, believe none of what you hear and only half of what you see. And the other little gem was, the pay is the same for rubbing out as much as it is for drawing in. Because we were on drawing boards in those days. So, you know, if somebody criticises it and you have to change it, the pay's the same, guys. You know, you have to go back. And if you use that as a philosophy, you have to understand that, you know, you get so far down the piece, you are going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
So that's the point at which you do the rubbing out. And you go back and you do it again. And the rival was really good at that. It was encouraged to do something in order to go forward and learn from the mistake that you make, and the next thing will be better. You know, is it somebody quotes Edison of saying, you know, about the light bulb, and he made 99 of them that didn't work. You know, so he invented 99 light bulbs that didn't work. But out of that, he learnt to make the one that did. So, there's a lot to be said for that. And I think, far too much in companies these days, and a lot of the traditional OEMs, they don't do that. They follow the same process, and they have all these design guidance and rules that stops you innovating, because you might make a mistake and that might cost money, and that holds you back. You do need to be able to allowed to make mistakes.
And do you know what, Glenn? Because you know, John's question, you know, what have you've learned? Your answer was, well, I can't really look back. I need to look forward. And what is really encouraging is kind of what you're doing today in your day job. I know that you've kind of created this panel. Where if I'm a startup and I've got this brilliant engineering idea, I can bring that to you to rip apart. And all of the wisdom that we've just heard about, these journeys through the arrival processes and the people and the redevelopment and changes within Optair and learning, you know, through Rolls-Royce and the drawing board, all of that's now being poured into the next generation.
Absolutely.
Tell us about what you're doing.
So, Prospedia Capital, we're seven individuals, all similar point in our careers. We've all been through the buying and selling of companies. We've made more money than others, but we've been through that process. We're all engineers and we've seen the pitfalls. And so we've come together to assist startups and businesses that are going through these painful phases in getting investment. So we bring together all too often, and you'll see this on the Dragon's Den, you've got the inventor of the product talking one language about how wonderful and whizzy the gadget is. And then Deborah Meaden asks, well, what about the money? And the guy's got no idea.
Yeah.
And these conversations just fall. And we're the bridge. We try to be the bridge. So people register on our platform. We go through a process of understanding their business. And then if they engage with us, we can get them investment ready. We give them all the questions they're going to be asked by the investors. We make sure that they've got the answers. They've got the people and the traction to make it work. And then we do investor pitch events. We have investors that register on our platform, all FCA regulated, and we run a pitch event, and those investors can invest in those pitches and take that to the next level. Because in a lot of cases, a lot of what government's funding through APC and others, it needs matched funding. So none of these things can be got off the ground with the government funding alone. You've got to get private equity investment, and that becomes more and more difficult to get. So Prospedia Capital is probably the only automotive focused accelerator that's out there. And we've got a combined sort of 300 years of experience, and between us in business, we've raised over 500 million for our respective companies. Having gone through this process and made those mistakes in the past. So it's the opportunity to allow others to learn from our mistakes, just as you were saying. And I think that really is the best that we can give back. And now I'm also consulting. I hate that word, but advising other companies, doing contracts for companies to help with business development and to help share that I've learned. So hopefully they don't make those same mistakes, and to give them the advantage in the future. So that's the sort of thing I'm doing at the moment. It's quite varied. It's interesting, but not ready to hang my boots up yet and sit by the fire.
Thank goodness.
There's only so much grass you can cut. So, you just got to get out there and do some stuff.
What is it about mistakes that are so powerful?
It's the learning, isn't it? I always remember Dennis telling me a story about a practical example where they took a group of project managers, group of engineers, and a group of kids and various groups, a group of accountants, and they set them one of these straw-making tasks to build a structure from straws that would hold a certain weight. And the project managers were still working out how they were going to do it when they ran out of time. The engineers ultimately triumphed with their structure, but the kids started making it and failed many times. But in the end, they came second. Without any knowledge, but just by purely trying it until they came up with a solution that worked. And so that really sort of drove the mantra arrival, particularly in the early days. It was about get the bits you need and try it rather than spend months analysing it and working out whether it's going to work, because it was all about speed to market, getting the answer very quickly, and the power of that mistake, really, of learning what not to do. The important thing is not to forget what not to do. That's the other thing as you go, and hopefully I can share some of my experience of what not to do. That's not to say we should always do things the same way, but there are some ways of doing things that actually just don't work, and it's important to listen and not to take things in too much detail as well. I came across a young man who tried to convince me, with my many years of experience, that it was the right thing to do to make the tyres on the arrival bus 15 millimetres wider at the back than on the front, because otherwise this vehicle was going to have severe oversteer. It was going to be dangerous. Now, knowing that a bus wheel turns round very slowly once a week, the average speed of a bus in traffic is 8 miles an hour. Its maximum speed is 50-odd miles an hour. The danger of the guy in the fitting shop putting the wrong tyre on the wrong wheel or mixing them up on the axle is far, far more dangerous than when somebody's trying to drive it like a McLaren around a racetrack. So... But this guy just couldn't get that because he couldn't see the wood for the trees and couldn't see in practice that actually, all the wheels needed to be the same size. Otherwise, that was going to be a big issue for the industry, not a problem on the racetrack, which is where his background was and all the calculations that he'd learnt in college. So hopefully brilliant. I can bring that experience into these companies. You can't make everybody won't listen, but and I don't have all the answers, but hopefully, I can bring some of that knowledge of 40 odd years in the industry.
One of the key things that you are able to do, Glenn, very clearly, is take complex things that you can do because you're an engineer, and you can storytell, which is quite unusual. It's an unusual combination. Have you always been able to tell a good story? Because I could sit and listen to you. Your knowledge is extremely high, but you make it so easy to listen to and so easy to understand. Have you worked on that, or is it just a natural ability?
It's just been natural. Simplifying things the way I view any problem is to simplify it. People will look at the complexity. And so I tend to look at extremes. So if I change this thing to one end, this is going to happen. If I change it completely to the other end of the scale, that's going to happen. Mm. My job is to work out where the answer is in between. And I can see first principles, and that's often what people miss. They know how to drive a computer or whatever, but they don't understand the first principle behind why it's delivering that result, or understand if there's an extra naught on the answer. And it's always been my ability to break things down simplicity into simple things to explain to people. And I guess I've done that, since my early career, and also in my sort of private life as well. I've been able to explain engineering concepts to people in simple terms at the correct level. Talk to kids, and get them understanding actually what's going on inside. Yeah. I struggle with software, I have to say. That's a weakness.
It does explain, though, why you're so friendly with Paul. He does simple really well. Anyway, moving on.
Glenn, don't be fooled. That's John being rude. Well, Glenn, listen. I could just keep asking questions. I'm curious about Dennis, coming from his world to the world that he, obviously was a telecoms person, telecoms and software in Russia, and then suddenly, he builds this business which became iconic really in our time, almost the DeLorean of vans in many ways. I don't know if that's a positive thing or not, but
was it the highest capitalized unicorn ever in the UK when launched, and had the market not changed and the share price held, I think you would definitely have seen a rival deliver on a lot of those promises without a doubt. The world That's changed in 2020 in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime, and people's views changed. 2 years of my life setting up the business ready for growth just went into a file, and okay, I enjoyed doing it. That's why I have to look back and say, well, I enjoyed doing it. It was an experience in life. We do look back with a bit of sadness, but it was a vast experience for everybody involved, and a great time to be involved as well. As an engineer, this era we're in is a great time as well. If you think about it, in the 1900s, we had diesels and steam engines and electric cars and stuff like that, and then we just settled on one and ran all that way through until now. And now all of a sudden, all the gloves are off and everything's on the table, which is equally why I'm not just an EV man. For me, we shouldn't be defining technology as it's only EV. We should be
agreed.
We should be saying what the requirements are, what the end game is, and then letting the engineers provide the solution to that.
Absolutely.
We don't need today. We say, right, you'll say we need a windscreen in that car because the guy's got to be able to see out. No, that is a specification. The requirement is that you as the driver need to be able to see the road ahead. Now, if there's a better way of doing that with a virtual reality headset and a whole host of cameras that gives you way more visibility than looking through that screen with its pillars and things in the way, we should be opening that up because that gives the opportunity. Same with an aeroplane. We put holes in the side, which are not structurally great, so that you can see outside, not for putting windows in. So why, you know, we could have a 24-inch TFT screen on the side of the wall there, no hole in the side of the plane, and you could see what's going on perfectly. So you need to think, what is the requirement, not what is the answer. Don't prescribe solutions, prescribe the requirement.
So here's the thing. I heard that before. And I've heard that. John, you've heard it before. Because we listened to Ross Brawn of, you know, F1 fame in particular, articulate that exact thought. And I didn't understand what he meant. I now understand what he meant. And I can kind of see what he meant by kind of let's let the engineers come up with the solution, like the structural integrity of an aeroplane, or we need people to see, so we've got to put a window in. No, you don't get to say we got to put a window in. You just get to say we need people to see.
Yeah.
And then that's the bit. Let the engineers work out the most viable solution.
Yeah, and the scientists. I shouldn't forget the scientists, should I? I talk about engineers too much, but scientists as well. So, you know, when we talk about decarbonisation, it should just be that. If we need to remove carbon, everything should be on the table. And that shouldn't just be we've all got to drive an EV.
Yeah.
Is there a solution, maybe one that I've not invented yet, that gives us that as well? Maybe biofuels have got a place, maybe not, but we should put all these things on the table and provide, you know, let the engineers provide the solution. We require energy. We don't require renewables. We require clean energy. So everything should be in the pot there in order to do that. I mean, I can have an opinion on which will go in the correct way, but I would never take one particular solution off the table, because different solutions fit for different things. I think hydrogen's got a good part to play in transport. Others will argue it's inefficient, you know, but I would also argue that overhead catenary wires to drive articulated trucks down a motorway isn't going to happen. We've not managed to electrify the railway in 50 or 60 years. So how the hell are we going to do it with trucks? It might have a solution in a particular environment, in a country or a particular route that works. Mm-hmm. So don't take it off the table. So I can have an opinion on some of these things in different routes, but we should leave it all up to all on the table. Otherwise, we'll miss something.
Both John and I would sing off that as hymn sheet. There are others that probably don't listen to the podcast, actually, so I could probably say and then challenge him to go and find it. Some don't necessarily agree. I mean, you know, I'm interested. I'm curious. You know, we're looking at both Stellantis in the Movano and Renault in the Master coming with the hydrogen solution. You know, is it going to work? I don't know. My opinion is probably not in that sector. But why wouldn't we test and learn? If somebody's got the money to go and kind of create the thing, let's leave the option on the table, go and learn if it does something, because the ultimate aim is zero emission from our transport. But the actual ultimate aim is almost one step higher than that. It's the climate returning to whatever is normal for the climate in its cycle, and air quality to be good locally. You know, that's the ultimate requirement, isn't it? That we don't all crash and burn as a life. Yeah.
So if I come up with a tree that I've genetically engineered and I can plant it in the centre of London and it sucks all those particulates in and it eats all the carbon and everything like that, I've waved a magic wand and it's all gone away, why wouldn't we look at that? You might say I'm crazy.
No, stop, you're not crazy. Stop. You're really, really insightful. And here's the reason why.
And you're running ahead of the whole plot. So now then, Glenn, we have a tradition here on the EV Cafe Takeaway podcast. And that tradition is you get to wave a magic wand.
So I just waved mine.
The world that you would do, well, you might you've had your one wish, you now get another one. This is by tradition, we hand it through the camera, so please feel free to take the magic
thank you,
one.
Thank
there
you very go. Much. That's I've got it. Here we go. I've got it's turned into an arrival pen. How did
it's
that
an
happen?
Arrival pen.
I can't believe how many incredibly intelligent people take this mystery mystical wand. In reality, you're all bonkers.
I've got an arrival pen somewhere. I'm just seeing if I got. Oh.
So I guess my magic wand, as you can guess, really is to get people to open up to that thinking that nothing should be off the table, and if we come up with other solutions, some of which we don't know about, maybe it's fusion technology, though we've been banging on at that for many, many years, that we shouldn't be guided by politicians. I guess that's a pet hate of mine. You know, they tend to... I remember going through consultation with some politicians in the last government, which entailed us listening to what they'd got to say. It was very little in the way of listening going on and a lot of telling what was going to happen. So take the politicians out. If you could make it apolitical, and yes. then just let's decide what the end game is and all solutions on the table. I've worked with some really clever people that have got some great ideas, and I think there's loads more great ideas to come out, not just the ones we know about today. So stop arguing on LinkedIn about whether it's hydrogen or whether it's EV or whatever. And again, that's a solution, not a requirement. What is the requirement? And let's everybody work towards that requirement.
You're absolutely right.
Glenn, that's brilliant. I'm because obviously... I don't want to end this, by the way, so we're just going to carry on for a minute or two more, Glenn, as long as you've got time. But it does seem that money is a barrier. And I know money shouldn't be, like, endless. I know it shouldn't be free and you know, share price and value and all that sort of stuff. And we've seen the market be all over EV and all over zero emission technology. We've seen the market and we recognise that things like hydrogen at the moment are currently massively expensive. We also know that there are other good companies on the verge of or struggling for money. How do we get around that problem? Does government have a role there? Is it helping these businesses to articulate their proposition better, like doing what you're doing with your I can't remember the name of it.
Prospedia Capital. Yeah. So I think you're right. That's the answer is to get these guys to articulate their ideas better. To put it, there's a gap between those people who are clever at inventing stuff. And those people that have got the money and don't understand the invention. You know, and you can see it played out on a Thursday evening on Dragon's Den, if you like. But more so in our industry, because it's a technical industry, there's a bigger gulf, a bigger gap between those ideas. And the money does have to flow. There is some government money, but for government money to flow, private money has got to flow as well. The government can't do
match
it on
fund.
Its own.
Yeah.
So... Mm. It's got to be apolitical, and we've got to link together. And that's what we firmly believe in Prospedia Capital, that we can bring these people together. And the best ideas will come to the top. Again, you know, there are thousands of people out there looking for money. The best prepared will get the money. The best ideas will get the money. And then market will drive. We talk about the marketplace, out the whole world is a commercial market, isn't it? Even places like China and the way they operate, they're still operating in a commercial way. It's a commercial business. So at the end of the day, as we talked much earlier about making the product save money, that's where it'll go. And some of that will be naturally happening as well. If we forget the environmental agenda for a minute and we carried on burning all of our fossil fuel, it's going to run out. It will run out at some point. They told us it was going to run out in 1970. It didn't. We found different sources of it. We found better ways of extracting it. But it will. You can't rely on it forever. So we've got to look to the next thing. You've got to be working for the next great opportunity. And that will become cheaper because the cost of those fossil fuels will rise. That has to come. It won't carry on at the low level that it is. Ultimately, that will rise as well. So the cost of our new technologies will reduce as they get better. We get closer to that, and the cost of our old technology will increase and therefore become unviable, or we will take the benefits. You know, one of the things you may not know is that I also own a 1930 steamroller, which travels at 4 miles an hour and consumes, you know, half a ton of coal to go a few miles down the road. Surprisingly, we don't still make those because it's much cheaper and much more efficient to have an electric construction machine that we've charged up and we use to mend the roads. And we don't use it. So it's confined to the history books and to those of us who are enthusiastic enough to keep it going and show people what was there before. And I won't be here, but in another 50 or 100 years, people will be looking at what we're doing today and saying, look what those guys were doing with their steamrollers, you know. And the arrival van will be consigned to steamroller history with some some guy running one round saying this was an arrival van.
It'll be Chris Felton.
Yes, it will.
Chris from Felton, yeah. Glenn, it has been an absolute joy to talk to you. And, you know, I'm thrilled that arrival happened. You know, I think, you know, you can't be sad that it's over. You have to be happy that it happened.
Yeah.
Yes, sad that it's over. And I was glad that you did confess some sadness as to the fact that it ended.
Yeah. You can't not be sad at all. Yeah, no. It's...
No. Because it was an amazing idea. And I think it's triggered other good ideas. You know, somebody pointed out that the BYD, I think it's called the Evali or something like that, is remarkably similar in its fascia, yeah, to the arrival van. So
the way in which we operate these things, the way in which we buy and sell them, all those things were up for change. And you'll see in the industry people making those steps now to make it easier for people. They'll take those little ideas. And you can more or less click for anything these days, can't you? God knows what happens in another 50 years when we've decided that clicking's too much like hard work.
we'll be back to our magic wand.
Yeah,
so that's what's happened. And do you know what? This was printed. So it's 3D printed. Now, I mean, it's a dark art, right? You know, it's like, well, how did that happen? But these are the things that, you know, we've got to keep in mind, haven't we? That things that we couldn't even think about, and had no concept of 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, are suddenly now a reality in our hand in a moment or, you know. So Glenn, you've been at the heart of that, and it sounds like you're going to, you know, see out your career in the heart of it by being involved in startups and doing all of that kind of stuff. And I'm, you know, as I think about what did Arrival give us that's still here, and you've articulated like Cinta, Soda, Minimal. And all of these other companies. And actually, it gave me the pleasure of looking at Charge because I love that car. I just did say, everybody, I loved the car. It was gorgeous.
Charge, I think that'll reappear somewhere. I think there's Rayon, who are a battery company, a group of the battery guys that were involved with. Yeah, and many others haven't haven't ended up as new businesses, but those people have gone to other businesses.
Yeah.
A number of the team went to Volta, they went to HVS. And I'm sure those projects, I know they've gone through tough times, but I saw only yesterday that Volta are championing. We're back, we're doing something, you know.
Carla's back.
It's good ideas won't die. At the end of the day, you know, they may run out of cash at one point, but somebody will pick up on those ideas. And all too often, it's sad to me that the way our the way our system works when businesses like that go into administration, you know, they're looking for investment and they're looking for partners. And those partners say, you know what, if we just sit back and wait for this to go bump, it's going to be a lot cheaper. And we put those...
Cynical, isn't it?
It is. And we put all the people in that business through that, you know, through that heartache, and then try to gather them back. And it happened. We saw it happen with COVID, with the businesses that shut, restaurant goes out of business, etc. You know, few months later, a new entrepreneur's come in and started a business in the same spot, whatever. The first guy lost all of his money, lost his shirt. The business is actually still there, but because of something that he had no had no control over whatsoever, it's gone. So, that's a frustration, I guess. And it's tricky, really, to make sure. And this is why one of the things we try to do at Prospedia is not just get that first investment, but follow those businesses through the process. So when they go into other rounds of investment, of which they're likely to be several, before we see a strong company making profits and delivering into this difficult technical industry. We like to drive that through the whole process and, you know, be by the side of those people.
Brilliant. John, I'm looking at you for a final thought, my friend.
Do you know what? My final thought is thank you so much, Glenn. And I genuinely mean this, because what you've done is reframed my last 2 weeks of work. So you've talked about specifying the requirement, and I'm very much a solutions person. And what I've done is I've created the 2025 plan for the EV Cafe for the year with Paul and with the team. And what I've realised is that what I need to do is to specify the requirement. What is it that we actually need to achieve? Not here's the solution, put windows in the plane. And I need to go back to first principles, and I need to redo my last 2 weeks of work. So bless you, my friend, because your wisdom is phenomenal and it's so easy to grasp and will change many, many businesses. So I'm going to encourage everybody I know to listen to this, because you're a genius.
I've never been called that before, but yeah.
No, you are.
I'm glad I've helped your thinking without John.
Do you know what, mate? There's a lot of bullshit in the world, but the reality is you just come at it straight as a die. You say it as you see it. You back it up with the experience. You say difficult things simply. You're a decent human being. Don't look back. Don't stare. That's okay. You've got two eyes on the front of your head. Use them to go forward. Love it. Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am available, as I said earlier, for weddings, funerals, and bar mitzvahs.
I'm not having a bar mitzvah. You're not coming anywhere near me. Not with a knife.
If I can help any of the businesses out there that, you know, listen to this podcast, and you know, I can use some of the. I'll call it wisdom of years, then I'm here, and it's been my passion for the last 40 years, and it isn't going to stop anytime soon. So
thank goodness. Good man. Thank you,
Glenn. You know what, Glenn? When I agreed, we bumped into each other and we agreed to do this podcast, I was thrilled, because I thought I would get the inside skinny on the arrival story. What I've been given is a lesson in positivity and a lesson in the power of mistakes, because the mistakes that were made, and of course because the business ultimately failed, possibly not ultimately through any real fault of its own, I think the market economy changed dramatically, and you can be forgiven for not being able to navigate that. I think that is, you know, that's forgivable, right? But the power of mistakes and what fertile ground Arrival was to create many, many other ideas, many trees that ultimately will suck carbon out of the environment, whether they're trees or whether they're vehicles or whether they're whatever. But metaphorically, there's going to be a lot of trees planted in urban centres that are removing carbon from our society or not producing it in the first place. And it's exciting. And I'm really grateful to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Pleasure.
But thank you also for learning, using that learning and that experience for the future generation. Mm. That really excites me. So anybody that's listening to this podcast right now, you should be sharing it with that person that you know that's got that great idea, with that business that you've watched for a little while. And, you know, you're not certain that they're going to make it because maybe they can't get the cash in. Maybe Glenn is somebody that can come along and help. I think just maybe that's true. So reach out to Glenn. You can follow him on LinkedIn. You've heard that he's sitting in the background there looking at all the arguing about hydrogen and things and taking no nonsense as well. So connect up with him on LinkedIn, reach out. And a wonderful team. We haven't talked about the wider team, but I know he can connect you with some amazing people. And of course, if you've loved this podcast, please do share it with a friend, just in general, and head over to the evcafe.org. You can see all of our podcasts there. You can also follow us on Apple and Spotify. You can do all of those wonderful things, and you connect with us on LinkedIn and do all those wonderful things. And of course, you can message us too. Well, listen, it's been great, Glenn. We've loved this. John, I think we've got some thinking to do.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, can I just say, this is now an official EV Cafe world record for the longest and most fabulous podcast ever.
Talk for England? Yeah.
1 minute and 16 and a half seconds has to be a world record. I think an hour and four was my previous longest.
Okay.
This is off the
scale. I've got a funny feeling there's one slightly longer, but I think
if you get Paul and I in a room for a while, we'd talk forever, wouldn't we?
Do you know what? That sounds like a good night out.
But I'll be asking questions and Glenn will be giving answers because I definitely have more questions than answers. But it's been fabulous, mate, and I'm thrilled.
It's a pleasure.
I can really see a lot of mileage in this, and a lot of people will learn a lot of wonderful stuff. And I've got a new way of looking at Arrival, and I thank you for that above everything, because I can look at it less with sadness and more with positivity. And that's a great place to be. Thanks, Glenn. And thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Have a wonderful day. And make sure you share this with a friend. See you now.